Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The last 5 days in 4 minutes to start us off, putt-putt golf to keep us going, and college football to ease us on into the weekend. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 15th of August today. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. It being a Friday, we will spend a couple of minutes, 4.5 to be precise, as we get going here to take stock of the week that was. A wrap-up, if you will, of the 5 days gone by. For that, we've got Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. He is down in Washington, D.C. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider is in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
Lynette, I will start with you, and to begin, I would like a steely-eyed, clear-headed analysis of what exactly the heck is going on in the global economy. Europe this week had flat economic growth. Japan was down 7% year-on-year, we learned. Hello?
Well, what we're seeing is that a lot of the policies that were put in place to get those economies going during crisis, in other policies meant to inflate the economies, just really aren't working.
That's not a good enough answer. There's got to be more. It can't just be that, right, Lynette?
Well, one thing that a lot of people are saying is that Mario Draghi over in Europe, he figured out how to stop the crisis, but he never figured out exactly how to spur growth in the Eurozone.
So, Sudeep, let me ask you this then. If you roll all this in together, does this mean that we're next? I mean, we have huge business relationships and economic relationships with all of Europe and with Japan as well.
We're not necessarily next. They're all really working hard to try to make us look good, because now we all should feel better about our really disappointing recovery because everyone else is doing far, far worse. I suppose maybe that's their goal in all of this. We saw over the course of the last few years a lot of cycles of turmoil in Europe. Obviously, in 2011, everything that was happening in Europe was weighing on the United States, both markets and the economy. And there is a risk that as the rest of the world struggles, and it's not just Europe and Japan, it's also China that has all sorts of problems on the horizon that could drag us down, because it's going to drag down global growth and certainly global growth potential. Mm-hmm. It just certainly means that we're not going to get the big liftoff we've been hoping for. And if we haven't realized that by August of this year, then we have to realize it now.
Yeah. All right. Speaking of us getting a liftoff, Lynette, we did a story this week on retail sales, which came in flat, as you know. And I, in the process of setting up that story, said, hey, American consumers, what is the matter with you guys? You have to shop because, you know, 70% of this economy is you or spending devoted to you. And listeners let me know in no uncertain terms that they didn't think much of that, that they basically said, listen, you moron, how can we shop and buy things when wages are flat, when unemployment is still at 6.2%? And so the question is, should we just get used to that? The consumers aren't going to be able to step up and take the load in this economy now?
All eyes are on the Fed. We're watching wage inflation and income growth in that way. But yeah, for the most part, I think the big story this week in terms of that retail story in general was Walmart reporting earnings and actually lowering their guidance. They're saying, hey, you know, we thought that we were going to be able to pump out a certain amount of revenue in terms of sales over the next two quarters, but now it's not looking as great as we thought it would. So, you know, we were seeing a little bit of optimism towards the end of last year, people thinking that things were going to turn around. And then slowly, May, retail spending was like at 0.4%.
Yeah, right.
And in June, 0.2%. July comes in flat. It seems like the American consumer is starting to sputter out, and we need some wage growth before we can get this economy really going again. But at the same time, if there's no demand, corporations are like, how are we gonna raise wages?
Right. And Sudeep, I mean, there is no inflation in this economy. There's no, you know, nobody's raising wages. There's no pressure to hire workers or any of that stuff.
There really isn't. And what you're seeing in retail spending and retail sales, what you're seeing in much of the economy is the tale of two economies. You're seeing pretty good responses among higher-end consumers, higher-end retailers, and it's pretty pitiful among lower-end consumers and retailers who are targeting them. And so that's been the case all along. You're not seeing wages pick up, though you're seeing the stock market still levitate at pretty steady high levels. And until that fixes fixes itself, and the most of America comes to match where the highest Americans have been performing, then you're not going to see the broad-based recovery we've been hoping for.
Yeah, and the odds of that, honestly, in 5 seconds or less, Sudeep, is slim, right?
Very low, yeah.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal in Washington. Lynette Lopez from Business Insider up in New York. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
See you, Kai.
Bye, Kai.
On Wall Street today, you know, it was fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can just go ahead and chalk one up for old media, people. There was an article in the New York Times yesterday detailing the struggles of a woman working irregular hours at Starbucks, irregular like working late into the night and then starting at 4 the next morning. The company, in response to that article, says it will do better. Among other things, it's promised work hours will be posted a week ahead of time and that it will make its scheduling software more flexible. But Starbucks is far from the only company that uses workers when and only when it needs them. It's a widespread practice in retail, in hospitality, and in healthcare as well. Marketplace's Adrian Hill explains what's called just-in-time labor and why some companies are reconsidering it.
Employers don't want to pay employees to sit around. And more often, they don't. Computers, with all their fancy data and algorithms and software, and lack of human emotion, have helped companies produce schedules that ensure people only work when they are needed.
They look at ongoing trends. They look at what a store or, you know, a restaurant or whatever it is did last year at this hour.
Susan Lambert is a professor at the University of Chicago. She says these predictive programs then factor in specifics.
In Chicago, it might be whether there's going to be a Bears game or what the weather's likely to be.
And then spit out a work schedule that can be tweaked again depending on how busy a place gets.
I think it's all about cost cutting, really.
Peter Capelli is a professor of management at the Wharton School. He says to make it all work, some companies require employees to be on call 40 hours a week for part-time jobs.
Sometimes they make them show up. And you've got to commute and drive a fair bit, and then you discover whether or not they're going to need you, but they require that you show up.
All of which can make it very, very difficult to manage your life, to arrange daycare, go to school, work a second job. Joan C. Williams directs the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law. She says there are companies out there starting to take these issues seriously. Right now, she's working with The Gap on a pilot program to stabilize schedules.
You want to be a high-road employer who employs low-wage workers. Just-in-time scheduling has begun to seem inconsistent.
Williams says the focus on cutting costs by matching labor supply and labor demand ignores the other costs of people quitting or not showing up because they can't balance their unpredictable work schedules with the rest of their lives. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Coca-Cola announced today it's buying a nearly 17% stake in Monster Beverage, maker of the eponymous energy drinks, for a bit more than $2 billion. People have been cutting back on sugary drinks of late, but the energy business has been on a tear. So as part of the deal, Coke said it's going to give its existing energy drinks to Monster, and Monster will give its non-energy drink brands to Coke. Neat and tidy, right? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the swap.
Reactions to the deal can pretty much be summed up as it's been a long time coming, and it's a win-win for both companies. Darren Tristano is the executive vice president of Technomic.
It really is well-suited for both organizations to focus on what they do, what they're known for, and what they do best.
Tristano thinks these types of swaps are rare, but it'll allow each company to focus on its strengths. Coke was late to the energy drink game, and its own attempts haven't been nearly as successful as Monster or its main competitor Red Bull. Both those companies have been really good at targeting younger consumers, says Ross Colbert, a global strategist for beverages at Rabobank International.
The category is very competitive. It takes a lot of merchandising because of the perception of, you know, high action, high activity, youthful demographics.
By clearing the decks of its other brands, Monster can focus on energy, fed by the help of Coke's huge distribution network. Tom Perko is the president of beverage consulting company BevMark. He says Coke gets some popular brands too, like Hansen's Natural Sodas.
So it adds a little bit of flesh to their portfolio too, and it gives them the kind of things that they really concentrate on. So we have a nice sort of division of labor.
Perko says Coke may be the biggest beverage company in the world, but it needed to buy what it couldn't build on its own. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you're a golf fan, you know Rory McIlroy won the PGA Championship last weekend. If you're not a golf fan, well, Rory McIlroy won the last major tournament of the year last weekend. But there is another golf get-together that starts today in Oceanport, New Jersey that might be of interest to you. I am speaking here about the U.S. Open Miniature Golf Tournament. Yes, putt-putt. There is, in fact, a miniature golf circuit on which people do play professionally. And I know what you're thinking here. Really, Kai, you can make a living playing miniature golf? Here's Marketplace's Queen of Kim.
Before you dust off your putter, I'll answer Kai's question right away. No, you cannot make a living playing miniature golf. But that doesn't mean the miniature golfers aren't taking the U.S. Open really seriously. Carol Newman works for Bluegrass Mini Golf in New Jersey, which is hosting the competition. It starts today, but she says golfers have been arriving for the past week.
They'll come at 7 o'clock in the morning and practice till 6 o'clock at night. They have a notebook.
And like professional PGA golfers, they use those notebooks to map out the course. The U.S. Pro Mini Golf Association runs the competition, and about 50 golfers are competing this year. The winner can make up to $3,500. Rick Robichek is with the Pro Putters Association, which also puts on miniature golf tournaments around the country. He calls himself a professional member. And so I asked him, does that mean he makes a living doing this?
No, not at all. That actually was a dream back in the 60s and 70s.
One, two, tres, cuatro.
Robichek says back then, the putt-putt chain of miniature golf courses, which is still around today, put on tournaments as a way to market itself. Those competitions would draw hundreds of people who made real money.
Some players earned like $3,000, $4,000 in a single season.
That's about $30,000 in today's money. Robichek doesn't see those glory days coming back, but he says in the decade he's been playing in tournaments, he's won a total of about $50,000. Not bad for a hobby. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
how about running through the stadium tunnel right before the game with more than 70,000 fans roaring in the stands?
How about it? That'll be $1,500, please. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 50 points today. A third of 1% closed at 16,662. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ nudged up 12 points, about a quarter percent. Ended things at 44.64. The S&P 500 was flat, ended at 19.55. For the week, the Dow up 0.7%. The NASDAQ put on 2.2%. The S&P 500 up 1.2%. The energy drink company Monster Beverage soared 30% after Coca-Cola, as we said, agreed to buy a stake in that company. Coke bubbled up 1.7% today on its own. Tech stocks got a boost led by Applied Materials, which jumped more than 6% after forecasting good sales numbers. Intel chipped up 0.2%. Nordstrom led department stores lower, falling 5% today. Bond prices soared as investors ran for the shelter of government debt. The yield on the 10-year T-note, get a load of this, down to 2.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market. Urban Outfitters is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And Monday is National Bad Poetry Day. Roses are red, violets are blue. Listen to Datebook. This one's for you. People, you have all weekend. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, I am going to read a list of companies, and I want you to tell me what they have in common, all right? All right, here we go. Google, Amazon, Facebook, Twitter. And lest you think the answer is that they're all tech companies, that's not the answer. So please allow me to continue. Disney, Harley Davidson, Mattel as well. They were all, once upon a time, startups. But when exactly does a company stop being a startup and start being just a company? Here's Sally Herships.
Normally, for this kind of story, I would start by playing tape from a new startup. Then I'd talk to older companies. But most of the people I talked to didn't agree. And when I asked when a startup stops being a startup, I got answers like this.
You're not going to get an answer to that question, Sally.
That was David Alk, COO of ShopKeep, a more mature company. We'll hear more from him later. So now that you know this question might have a fuzzy answer, let's start again at Kinesi, a startup in Brooklyn.
So one way to tell that you're at a baby startup is the location. This place is ages from the subway, and I'm super hot and sweaty, so I'm going to call them and tell them I'm here.
Brian Valentini is one of the co-founders. I asked him how you know a startup is a startup.
Well, you can ask them, do you have business cards? Something simple like that. The answer for me would be not right now.
Kinesi was founded in June, which means you can measure its age like a baby in weeks.
Do you have an HR department?
You're looking at it.
Valentini says for him, one sign a startup has stopped being a startup
is when you come in, you've started something, and it stops being fun.
I wanted to hear from older startups, so I stopped by Columbia Business School's Startup Lab in SoHo. It's a big room with high ceilings, long tables, and lots of entrepreneurs with laptops.
I'm not sure that a startup ever stops being a startup.
Benji Jack's startup Board Rounds has been around for a year. He says startupness is a frame of mind, being able to innovate and change quickly.
So I don't think one can point to Google and say, on this date, Google was no longer a startup.
Remember David Olk with ShopKeep? His office is just a few blocks away. And he agrees with Jack that plenty of public companies are run like startups. ShopKeep was founded 6 years ago, but...
we're a startup. Look, we have a pool table, we have a kegerator, we have a foosball table, we have free food.
Am I drinking a beer?
He probably is. He's standing behind me, isn't he?
Yeah. Olk says ShopKeep is a mature company and a startup. He says as CFO now, his focus is on day-to-day business. He doesn't have to worry about capital like he used to. But he says the company retains its startup qualities, like employees' ability to make decisions and ownership of their jobs. But then again, ShopKeep has about 130 employees. It's no Microsoft.
The problem is the larger you become as a company in terms of headcount, the more likely are smart people inside the company to become dumb.
Hayagriva Rowe is a professor at Stanford. He teaches classes like Scaling Up Excellence. He says he doesn't mean people become stupid. He told me about an anthropologist, Robin Dunbar.
He studied a number of species to find out what is the optimal size of a tribe or a social grouping.
Rowe says around 150 people. Beyond that, your tribe is going to break apart. The bigger a company is, Rowe says, the harder it is to know everyone's name, let alone what they do. Imagine you founded a startup that's grown from 2 employees to 2,000.
You know, you go to a meeting and say, who are these people? What the hell are they doing here?
So it's kind of ironic because once the company becomes successful, it kind of becomes its own enemy.
Exactly. That's exactly the problem. That's exactly the problem.
Rowe says companies like Google and Facebook are not startups. When they grow, he says it's nearly impossible to hold on to the culture. That's why companies like Google give venture capital money inside the company to try to stay Googly. Back at Columbia Startup Lab, Liz Wilkes, a founder of Exuberancy.com, is working on her laptop. She says a startup stops being a startup when it stops feeling like a family and becomes an organization with hierarchy and systems. But she also says startupness is cultural, which can be bad for business.
You know, when you meet like that guy who's like 40 and is wearing like a backwards cap and he's like at the bar with your friends who are in their 20s and you're like, oh, this guy might be a little too old to be here.
Wilk says if they're not careful, startups can get stuck in their teenage years. But she says if a company can hold on to the positive aspects of the culture and grow, it can be powerful. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
So Celebrity endorsements are absolutely nothing new. More than a decade after he retired, for the last actual time, Michael Jordan's name still brought in more than $2 billion for Nike last year. Apple just paid $3 billion a couple of months ago to snap up Dr. Dre's Beats audio brand. There are, however, some things celebrities just cannot sell, no matter how famous they are. Prepaid debit cards, to start with. Shannon Mullen reports.
Magic Johnson and financial advisor Susie Orman pulled their prepaid cards about a month ago. And the latest celeb to bow out? Try applying online for the card endorsed by rapper Lil Wayne, and you get an error page.
This was sort of low-hanging fruit.
Matt Britton is head of the youth marketing agency MRY.
Prepaid cards is really a growing phenomenon. So I think celebrities initially saw this is a great opportunity for me to be able to leverage my fan base.
Consumer spending with prepaid cards jumped 6% last year to more than $118 billion, according to the Nielsen report. Greg McBride with Bankrate.com says the cards are increasingly popular with people who don't want traditional checking accounts.
Or consumers that cannot obtain a checking account. A lot of these, particularly newer prepaid card offerings that have more transparent fee structures, make a pretty compelling option for them.
Hidden fees helped tank the Kardashian family's attempt at a prepaid card a few years ago. More cards disclose their costs now, but
the lack of regulation is the downside. These cards do not have any protection should you lose the card or it gets stolen.
Susan Weinstock is director of consumer banking for the Pew Charitable Trusts. She says federal regulators plan to weigh in on prepaid cards this summer. As for whether celebrities should keep endorsing them, Matt Britton at MRY says the star would need a broad enough fan base to make it work.
LeBron James, maybe?
I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
College football season starts in just a couple of weeks, and if you have always wanted to experience some of the thrills of the game without having either the physical gifts or the desire to be ground into a pulp, well, now you can, at least if you're a fan of the University of Southern California and you're willing to make just a small contribution. From KPCC, Ben Bergman reports.
Team on three, one, two, three, three.
A pregame tour of the locker room? That's $1,000. Want to say hello to the coach? $750, and he'll even sign a helmet. Or how about running through the stadium tunnel right before the game with more than 70,000 fans roaring in the stands? That will set you back $1,500. USC says the goal with these offerings is to improve the fan experience, to keep them from just watching the game at home. But what about the players' experience?
It's USC football. It's supposed to be honorable to be in that locker room.
That's Petros Papadakis on his LA Sports radio show. He captained the USC football team in 1999 and 2000.
It does feel a little weird to me to put a price on running out of the tunnel to play a football game, which we were told as players constantly that that was a very earned and special right.
And that's not changing, says USC's assistant athletic director Craig Kelly. These experiences are nothing like wearing the uniform.
Part of that honor is actually, you know, putting on the pads, putting on the helmets, and donning the Cardinal gold out of that tunnel. And I think when what we're offering isn't that.
Kelly says lots of schools lavish perks on donors, which is true. That's how the game is played. The most generous boosters get the ear of the athletic director to travel with the team and, of course, the best seats. At the University of Alabama, you can put your name on the coach's office for $1 million. What makes USC's approach unusual is they've gone mass market. That's according to Josh Rebholz, an associate athletic director at UCLA.
We do offer some of these experiences, but we believe that many of them, like running out of the tunnel with the team, are pretty sacred assets, and really we only offer them to the highest and most generous donors that we have.
In other words, these prized assets are so sacred they can only be sold for lots of money. Get on the sidelines for a UCLA game? That would cost up to $100,000. Want access to the tunnel and the locker room? You'll have to fork over $500,000. So here's the lesson, USC. It's not that you're commoditizing college football. Every school's been doing that for a long time. It's that you're probably not charging enough. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, which is a neat confluence of my lousy night's sleep last night, the rise of big data, and wearable technology, all in one little item. From the Wall Street Journal and from data provided by Jawbone, makers of one of those fitness bracelets that you see out there, this. We now know, just because we can, I guess, all kinds of stuff, like residents of which city in the world get the most sleep. That would be Melbourne, Australia, at 7 hours, 5 minutes a night. The least, the worst sleepers? Tokyo, Japan, 5 hours and 45 minutes. So now you know, just because you can. All right, we're done. The Dow off 50 points today, about a third of 1%. The NASDAQ up 12, a quarter percent. The S&P 500 pretty much flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yore. The program is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.